Greetings and welcome to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. On today's program, we'll have an update on Mexico with correspondent Peter Gellert, who'll tell us about the fallout from the recent crackdown in Chiapas by Mexican troops. Then we'll hear about the U.S. dirty war in Guatemala. As we reported last week, Guatemala remains in mourning following the death of Guatemala City's auxiliary bishop, Monseñor Juan José Geraldi Condera. Geraldi Condera was bludgeoned to death at his home on April 26th, sending shockwaves throughout Guatemala. But as our guest will explain, this is nothing new in that Central American country. Later in the program, we'll hear the keynote speech given at a recent conference held in New York City about the African presence in Puerto Rico and the construction of the Puerto Rican identity. All of this and more coming up next, but first, here are some stories making headlines this week in Our Americas.
With news from Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal. Colombian human rights groups are warning that paramilitary violence is escalating into a dirty war. On March 5th, 200 paramilitary gunmen went on a three-hour rampage through a remote village in eastern Colombia, killing 21 people, ransacking homes, and burning stores. Terrified survivors of the devastation said that the gunmen had arrived at the village of Puerto Alvira, announcing that the residents had 8 days to abandon their homes or else they'd be killed. Witnesses also said that the attackers had accused the entire town of supporting guerrilla forces and had a list of those they had chosen to die. Radio reports quoting villagers said that the victims included a 4-year-old girl whose body was left in the village square. Human rights groups are saying that far from being random murders, the paramilitaries are targeting left activists and social leaders, pointing to the recent murders of a human rights lawyer and a leader of the Colombian Communist Party.
The United States is refusing to allow any of its Latin American neighbors to suggest a new method of approving or condemning fellow countries for their efforts in combating drug trafficking. Acting on a suggestion made by the U.S. during the recent Summit of the Americas in Santiago, Chile, the Organization of American States, or OAS, has begun to discuss a possible continent-wide anti-drug alliance. Its goal is to reach consensus on an alternative to the present certification method employed unilaterally by the U.S., which the U.S. has admitted is conflict-causing. But Barry McCaffrey, the U.S. anti-drug czar, flatly declared at the OAS meeting that the certification process was U.S. law and would continue to be used until Congress saw fit to change it.
In Bolivia, coca farmers are continuing to fight their government's forced coca eradication program. 500 delegates from 6 coca growers' unions voted to protect their livelihood and that of 75,000 families who have no other means of subsisting. In the aftermath of last month's violent clashes between striking coca farmers and the army that left 5 dead, the highlands area of Chapare has continued to be occupied by military troops who are forcibly cutting down fields of coca. Rolando Vargas, secretary of the United Central's Federation, says that although the farmers are willing to negotiate, the government has shown itself uninterested in a dialogue since it has rejected the Catholic Church as a mediator. The coca farmers are warning President Hugo Banzer's administration that they may resurrect their self-defense groups to protect themselves against the government's anti-coca offensive, which they feel is also targeting their leaders.
Brazilian women are gaining ground in the fight for political equality and labor rights. Labor union and political parties, both seen as traditionally male arenas for struggle, have in the past 2 years seen more women running for executive organizational positions and winning. This is due to an affirmative action program sponsored by Brazil's First Lady, Ruth Cardoso, which requires that women candidates make up 25% of party election tickets. Women now also hold 30% of the executive positions in the Worker Central. This participation is crucial because, as the Organization of American States notes, women in Brazil earn on the average less than one half of what male workers earn, make up 60 out of every 100 unemployed workers, and head the majority of impoverished single-parent households.
Also in Brazil, the Landless Rural Workers Movement, or MST, is promising to organize more looting in the country's drought-stricken northeast to make sure that no one starves to death. In Gravata, a town 1,200 miles northeast of Rio de Janeiro, 500 starving peasants marched through the streets on March 5th, shouting, quote, "We are hungry," and broke into a supermarket grabbing what they could of meat, cornmeal, and rice. A tug of war followed as police and employees tried to grab the foodstuffs out of the marchers' hands. One farmer leader was injured by a club blow to the head, and 3 directors of the MST were arrested. The Catholic Church and a Brazilian Supreme Court judge have supported the movement as not a sin and justified under the circumstances. President Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who has so far planned to send enough food baskets to cover only half of the 10 million people affected, has lashed out at those sanctioning the looting. More than 350,000 people died from drought in the Northeast in the early 1980s, and malnutrition affects 40% of the region's children.
Chiquita Brands International, Inc., the world's largest banana company, is being accused of improper business practices, including secretly controlling dozens of supposedly independent Latin American banana companies in Colombia, Guatemala, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Honduras. In an investigative report, the Cincinnati Inquirer has also claimed that the company's lax security system has allowed Colombian drug lords to use their cargo ships for smuggling cocaine into Europe. Chiquita has responded that the report takes its findings out of context and portrays an inaccurate image of its company.
The leader of Colombia's indigenous Uwa tribe has taken his message of conservation straight to the shareholders of Occidental Petroleum. Roberto Covaria attended Occidental's annual shareholders meeting for the second year in a row, hoping to halt company plans to pump oil on lands claimed by his people, explaining that what they saw as potential oil profits was what the Uwa saw as the blood of Mother Earth. Covaria drove his point home with a song dedicated to her, while 400 shareholders and a row of expressionless company executives stared. Occidental acquired leases for oil exploration on the disputed land in 1992, but the Uwa, a 5,000-strong semi-nomadic tribe, have threatened to commit mass suicide by jumping off a cliff if Occidental brings in the drills. The small tribe has been successful in forcing Occidental to stop its drilling despite a target of doubling earnings from its oil business in the next several years.
In related news, 14 indigenous communities in Chubut State in Argentina have been left on their own by the government to deal with a state of emergency caused by heavy flooding in their communities. No help or official recognition of their dire situation has been offered. The leaders of the mostly Mapuche Indians say they feel humiliated and frustrated by the total disregard of a racist government. The Mapuches live in almost complete isolation without any transversible roads or bridges to reach their mountainous territories. The nearest medical facility that might deal with their overexposure to the elements and with the lung diseases that affect their communities are many miles away. Meanwhile, a report based on interviews with 200 top-level private sector executives in Buenos Aires has found that a majority of the respondents think that corruption has definitely increased over the last 5 years, in that, quote, in Argentina, businessmen tend to ignore ethical principles, and they only care about profits when making a decision. The report contradicts the widely held belief that the deregulation of the economy and mass privatizations carried out by President Carlos Menem in the 1990s would decrease corruption. And those are some of the stories coming out of Latin America this week. For Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal.
Listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean, I'm Mario Murillo. In other news, the Mexican army offensive in the southern state of Chiapas is picking up steam. In a surprise dawn raid on May 1st, 800 heavily armed state police, backed up by 400 army troops, entered Amparo Aguatinta, a Zapatista village close to the Guatemalan border, detaining at least 47 men, including 6 Guatemalan refugees, who were subsequently released. It was the latest attack against the indigenous communities in southern Chiapas and is raising concerns in the international community of increased human rights violations committed by the Mexican state security apparatus. Correspondent Peter Gellert is in Mexico City and prepared this report for Our Americas.
The Mexican government is stepping up attacks on Zapatista-led autonomous municipalities in Chiapas and is intensifying its war on the mass media against foreign observers. In the early hours of May 1st, a national holiday in Mexico, more than 1,000 police and soldiers violently raided and dismantled the autonomous municipality of Tierra y Libertad, comprised of 22 local villages. 52 Indian peasants were detained, 8 of whom are now being charged with rebellion and usurping authorities' functions. The autonomous municipalities are Zapatista-led villages where residents have elected their own authorities according to local traditions and resolve community problems in open assemblies by consensus decision, in the process ousting the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI. 38 such autonomous municipalities are functioning in Chiapas. Local residents charged that meager belongings, including their homes, were ransacked and destroyed in the operation, and detainees were beaten. Homes with pre-insignias, however, were left untouched. For the first time ever, busloads of women police were used to fire tear gas on and attack indigenous peasant women. More serious allegations include five-year-olds being tortured by state security police, sexual attacks on women and teenagers, and beatings of women and old people. The government said the action was in response to a petition from the UN High Commission on Refugees calling on authorities to intervene in favor of a detained Guatemalan citizen. In a subsequent communique, the UN High Commission denied it requested or had anything to do with a military move. The police and army raid follows similar attacks 2 weeks earlier on Zapatista municipalities. Thus, there is now a real danger of an attack on autonomous municipal seats of government in the villages of Polho and El Bosque. Chiapas Governor Roberto Albores said authorities would apply the law in these areas and no one should be surprised by it. Different views have been expressed across the political spectrum on whether or not the Zapatista autonomous municipalities are contrary to the law and indeed whether the government's recent actions are as well. In a May 4th declaration, the indigenous and Zapatista communities charged the Mexican government with using the UN as a pretext for its war against the Indian population. "We will not surrender. We will defend our communities to the end," the declaration said. On a related front, authorities are tightening the screws on foreign observers. The focal point this week was the presence of 130 Italian observers who were finally given restricted 10-day visas. The team defied immigration officials' refusal to allow them to visit the sites of the recent police military operations. They are now being threatened with possible immediate deportation. Interior Ministry Undersecretary for Immigration Fernando Solis said, quote, "Mexico does not want revolutionary tourists or observer experiments," unquote, and announced on Wednesday that new regulations would soon be drafted limiting the size of observer delegations, restricting the places they can visit, and requiring that they be backed by representative and serious organizations in their home countries. Government officials also continued with threats to investigate the San Cristobal Archdiocese for issuing credentials for foreign observers. The archdiocese is led by Bishop Samuel Ruiz, who is under intense attack for his role in the National Intermediation Commission, charged by authorities with being partial to the Zapatistas. President Ernesto Zedillo himself again went on the offensive when, on a Wednesday speech, he attacked so-called progressives who feel it is politically correct to attack Mexico as a country marked by oppression, mistreatment, and injustice toward its indigenous inhabitants. He urged them instead to study their own nation's colonial histories. While non-governmental organizations and the left-of-center party of the Democratic Revolution have condemned the recent military moves and government declarations, thus far, a mass response from civil society has yet to emerge. For Our America, this is Peter Gellert in Mexico City.
Guatemala remains in mourning following the death of leading human rights advocate Monsignor Juan José Gerardi Condera, Guatemala City's auxiliary bishop. Monsignor Gerardi Condera was bludgeoned to death at his home on April 26th. Gerardi was known for his work for human rights and with the indigenous people of Quiché province. At the time of his death, Gerardi was general coordinator of the Archbishop's Human Rights Office, the ODA, in Guatemala City. Gerardi's murder took place just 2 days after he formally presented a 1,400-page report titled Guatemala Never Again, which details the results of an investigation into human rights abuses committed during Guatemala's 36-year counterinsurgency war. The April 24th presentation of the report marked the conclusion, exactly 3 years after it started, of the Recovery of Historical Memory, the investigation project spearheaded by ODA. The report documents over 55,000 cases of human rights violations, which left over 1 million victims, and charges the army with responsibility for about 80% of these violations. The report also found the United National Revolutionary Unity, the URNG, the armed opposition movement, that they were responsible for almost 8% of the abuses. The URNG issued a statement condemning the Monsignor's killing, saying that it was a deliberate attempt to destabilize the country at a particularly critical moment and will have serious consequences for the peace process. Early this year, the URNG issued a report criticizing the government's compliance with the peace accords. Next week, we'll have an in-depth report on the state of the Guatemalan peace process. For now, we'll hear about the U.S. role in a dirty war in Guatemala from Kate Doyle, who's a senior analyst with the National Security Archives in Washington and the director of the Guatemalan Declassification Act. The NSA is a nonprofit organization that uses the Freedom of Information Act to force the government to declassify documents about U.S. foreign policy. Doyle spoke recently with Our America's Winifred Tate. She first described some of the work that the NSA was doing regarding Guatemala.
I have had a documentation project on Guatemala for the last 4 years now, specifically targeting declassified U.S. documentation on a number of national security and foreign policy issues relating to U.S. policy in Guatemala since the CIA coup of 1954. That is, documents concerning U.S. security assistance to Guatemala, the terrible human rights catastrophe that ripped through Guatemala during the internal conflict of civil war between the guerrillas and the government since 1960, the role of the Guatemalan military and police forces in human rights violations, the government's complicity in and cover-up of the violence of human rights violations, and essentially what the United States knew and when it knew it about the Guatemalan government's repression. And the way our projects work is that we file a number of Freedom of Information Act requests to the U.S. government asking that material contained within our government's agency archives be reviewed and declassified for the public. So that I've sent now hundreds of requests to the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, the Agency for International Development, which had extensive police programs in the 1960s in Guatemala and so forth, requesting that documents within their archives be released to the public about Guatemala for the years 1960 to 1996 when the peace accord was signed.
And what kind of information have you gotten back?
As of about 1996 or 7, so in other words, 2 or 3 years after we began filing our Freedom of Information Act or FOIA requests, we began to receive first a trickle and then a stream, and now a fairly steady flow of declassified documentation from most of the critical agencies that operated in Guatemala during the war. And the material we've received has been absolutely fascinating and has covered a wide range of topics. We have, for example, defense intelligence assessments on specific Guatemalan military officers, Guatemalan military units, and overall evaluations based on intelligence gathered within Guatemala of the armed forces and the police forces. We have a very small amount, but a very critical amount, of CIA intelligence memoranda or assessments reviewing the role of the guerrillas, the war, complicity between the Guatemalan government and the right-wing forces within the country for the violence, and any number of things related to the repression that took place in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then we have State Department cables. We have fascinating documents from the AID Public Safety Division, which, as your listeners probably know, had police training programs in Guatemala and elsewhere in Latin America and around the world during the 1960s and early 70s before they were shut down for the terrific amount of human rights violations that people were realizing they were engendering. OPS, the Office of Public Safety, had these programs in Guatemala training the police to surveil and target for arrest, supposedly, so-called subversives, people who were either the armed guerrilla forces or people that the police or military believed were sympathetic and to the armed left in Guatemala. And these documents have proven to be a very, very rich account, not simply of what the United States was doing in training the police forces in Guatemala, but also simply a very, very rich and important account of what the police forces looked like. What were the security forces in Guatemala in the 1960s and 70s? I'll tell you, any researcher or historian or national security scholar who wants to study that kind of information within Guatemala will have a terrible time at it because there is no information in the public realm on these subjects. So these documents are very, very valuable to researchers.
How are they being used by people within Guatemala, for example, who are trying to rebuild the country now that the civil war is officially ended with the peace accords?
There are a number of fascinating and innovative efforts going on within Guatemala right now to examine the violence of the past and try to analyze it and try to debate or discuss it publicly. Two of the most important efforts are something that came out of the peace negotiations and finally the peace accords that were signed in 1996 between the armed guerrillas and the government, which is called the Historical Clarification Commission of Guatemala. And this is Guatemala's version of the Truth Commission, something that, as your listeners know, has gone on in El Salvador, Argentina, Chile, and is now underway in South Africa as well. The Clarification Commission's responsibility is to investigate, analyze, and finally produce a public report on 36 years of violence, essentially the human rights violations that were produced in the civil conflict from 1960 to 96. It's a tremendous task. They have given themselves 1 year to do this, which is a bit frightening. But these documents, these declassified documents, I think are proving to be very important for their work. This is not by any means the center of their investigation. They are gathering testimonies in Guatemala all over the countryside from individuals and families and communities that have suffered during the war, testimonies about what happened to them during the conflict. They are also studying secondary sources. They are talking to former military officers and some current military officers. So they've had a broad and complex investigation underway. But these declassified documents, I think, are a very important part of that work. So they've been able to use them, and I assume are using them right now.
I know you recently traveled to Guatemala to bring some of these documents down there. Could you share a little of your experience there and what you saw and how people are working?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in the press, there is increasingly open debate and discussion about the war, which is a very encouraging development. Not to say that the Guatemalan press has ever been inhibited, because it's actually traditionally been a fairly open press when you compare it to some other countries in Latin America. But certainly the fact of the Historical Clarification Commission, the fact that that commission exists, is doing its work and has a public profile, combined with Remy's work, combined with forensic teams, which are now all over Guatemala, digging up clandestine burial sites. All of this activity, this process, and a lot of the credit should go to the Guatemalan human rights organizations as well for bringing this information to light, is being debated publicly in the press, in public fora, and universities. So that's a very important development. And then, as I said, the Clarification Commission does have a public profile, and I believe is planning to hold a public forum asking for recommendations that it can include in its final report about how to radically transform society so that society does not produce, Guatemalan society does not produce this terrible violence again. And that's a very important development, and I think it'll be fascinating to see how that forum is managed and what happens there. But in general, I would say that, you know, when I was there, the Clarification Commission and Remy, both of those projects were full steam ahead. The investigators are right in the middle of their work. They're traveling all over the country. They've had dozens of field offices to gather these testimonies. So this is a process very much underway right now. And we'll be able to see the results of that first, again, from Remy this month, and finally from the Truth Commission in, I believe, the middle of the summer, end of July, beginning of August.
Now that these documents are revealing the role that the U.S. played, the fact that the State Department, for example, consistently lied about what they knew and when they knew it and did participate in training Guatemalan officers involved in these human rights abuses, what is the chance that any of these documents will result in cases being brought against specific military officers, or do you think that the hope is more that these documents will lead to kind of a general acknowledgement of what happened without the possibility of specific trials?
That's very hard to say. I can tell you this, that there is no formal link. There is no link inscribed within the law between the Clarification Commission's findings and the judicial system. Whether or not the commission finds particular units involved in X, Y, or Z cases of human rights abuse, the judicial system is not then obliged to take those cases up in court. The second aspect of this, which is a discouraging aspect, is that I think most analysts of Guatemala will agree that the judiciary is probably the weakest link in all this. The judicial system is notoriously dysfunctional, corrupt, very, very weak. And so the likelihood of significant numbers of actual court cases resulting in the conviction of military officers is very, very small. That said, Guatemala, unlike El Salvador, by the way, did pass an amnesty. However, it is not a sweeping amnesty covering all crimes relating to the war. And one of the scandals of the Salvadoran peace accords and what happened afterwards is that something like a week or 2 weeks after the Salvadoran Truth Commission issued its report, and subsequently another commission called the Ad Hoc Commission issued a report naming military officers that these commissions believed had been involved in gross human rights violations and should be dismissed or tried in a court of law, shortly after these commissions released their report in 1993, the Cristiani administration passed a very broad amnesty, pardoning everyone linked to these violations. And one of the results of that amnesty was actually to free Salvadoran military officers who had been tried and convicted in the case of the murders of the Jesuit priests in 1989, free them from jail.
Kate Doyle is a senior analyst with the National Security Archives in Washington and the director of the Guatemala Declassification Act, a nonprofit organization that uses the Freedom of Information Act to force the government to declassify documents about U.S. foreign policy. She was speaking with Our America's Winifred Tate the day before Guatemala's auxiliary bishop, Monsignor Gerardi Condera, was bludgeoned to death in his home. This murder is raising new concerns about the fragile peace process in Guatemala. Next week, Winifred will have a full report on the fallout of this murder and how it may affect the implementation of the accords. And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. NACLA publishes a bi-monthly journal, Report on the Americas. For more information, you can call NACLA at 212-870-3146. That's 212-870-3146. And if you have any questions or comments for us, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.